Jeremy, are you a particularly sweaty guy?
No. I do not have rainforest underneath my arms.
Well, unfortunately, I can't echo the same. I would consider myself a somewhat sweaty gal. I've been that way since early adolescence. It was pretty embarrassing as a young person, and I certainly tried lots of different treatment strategies to control it. Well, the pop culture article that piqued my interest in this topic isn't like terribly recent. It was in 2021, but it's relevant. I feel like the "your deodorant will kill you" scare happened around then in 2021-ish, and perhaps it's prudent to like let a little time pass after a social media panic campaign and see what's left in the pot after the water boils over. So, it was a New York Times article called "Are Natural Deodorants Really Better for You?" Jeremy, what's on your armpits right now?
Besides hair,
Like what's on your armpit skin?
I understand. I have
You're being
Old Spice
obtuse.
antiperspirant.
Cute. How did you decide what to use?
It smells good. I got it on subscribe and save. It keeps me relatively dry. Hopefully, it's not killing me.
Good. And we'll get to that, don't worry. I actually have a couple products that I use. It depends on the day and my caffeine intake. I have one standard, like aluminum-containing antiperspirant, and actually a couple different, like natural deodorant brands. So, like this was relevant to my interests. The New York Times article has a great summation quote, and I love it when you make me read quotes. So maybe I'll just do it to you. All right. So this is the New York Times article has a great summation quote. Do you want to read the quote, Jeremy?
Sure. Quote, "Experts, including an oncologist, an epidemiologist, a skin microbiome expert, and several dermatologists, said there is no definitive evidence that regular deodorants or antiperspirants are worse for your health than natural deodorants. In fact, they said, they're perfectly safe."
So end of episode,
End
right?
quote. End quote.
End quote. Yeah, so like that's a little foreshadowing of what we're going to talk about if anybody wants, like the quick TLDR. But I would love to delve into all of the hoaxy stuff, all of the stuff that's actually kind of interesting that may nudge you in the direction of natural deodorants. But so, like why the worry about antiperspirants? Jeremy, would you believe me if I told you it started with a chain email?
Yes, I would.
Of course.
And that just means that it happened before social media existed.
Yes, it was in the 1990s. A chain
I was about to
emails.
say, this was social media. This was going viral before going viral existed.
Right,
Chain
exactly. Well, things
emails.
went viral. It was chain emails. Yeah, it slithered its way through the series of tubes that Al Gore called the internet back then. And it suggested that antiperspirants clogged your sweat pores, thus disallowing your body to purge itself of toxins. And those toxins would accumulate in your axillary, your armpit, lymph nodes, and increase your risk of breast cancer. And furthermore, there was more panic about if you shaved your armpit hair and then you applied this antiperspirant, that your risk would heighten even more by allowing nasty chemicals from the antiperspirant to infiltrate your pure baby armpit skin and wreak more havoc. What do you
And
think of
this
that?
email was started from a company who was trying to get rid of antiperspirants because they made natural deodorants.
I don't know, or original trolls is in the 90s, man. I don't know. But yeah, thankfully, your doctor friends are here today to clear up all this urban legend 90s junk. We want to combat the what I consider the purity slash purge your toxin detox scare tactics and present some actual helpful evidence on your options for keeping your pits clean, dry, and stank free. Or is it just better to be a sweaty little stink bug? The choice is yours. So, can we answer the question today? Will my antiperspirant make me sick? Welcome to Your Doctor Friends, the show that teaches you to sniff out the garbage and answers all the questions that you wish you could call or text your doctor friend. My name's Julie Bruni.
And I'm Jeremy Allen, and we are two physicians who work at a nationally ranked practice and take care of some of the world's greatest athletes. We know that you have questions, and we want to help.
We want to be your doctor friends. All right, we're back. I'm going to break this episode down into chapters because my little squirrel brain needs structure or it just scurries around the proverbial tree trunk. So, do you want to hear my chapters?
I do. I'm thinking, I just want to onus back to the quote that I had to read in the first
Yes.
section for just a quick moment. You cited your source, so I feel a little bit better about it. But just this concept of an oncologist, an epidemiologist, a skin microbiome expert, and several dermatologists all say there's no problem. So just trust it. We're good. You're like, those seven people walked into a bar.
And we all asked them about antiperspirant and deodorants.
You asked one specialist within one category of each, and they said there was no problem, so we're good.
It's consensus, right? Just a handful of people? Enough people that could fit in your car, probably? That's fine, right?
No, it's not the yes, it is not a consensus.
Agreed. Well, I will say that was a quote from the beginning of this longer article that then cites a whole bunch of sources, which I think that's a great teaching point, Jeremy, is to say, all right, headlines are not data. Headlines is not doing your research. Watching a TikTok video is one TikTok video is not doing research. I mean, it's doing, I guess you could call it doing research, but it's not certainly exhaustive research. I don't know if I would even call that research. So I think your point you're making here is, well, what's the point you're making here?
The point I'm making here is don't trust doctors just because they have a doctor or they say they're a specialist.
Yes, agreed. Look up, and just because a few of them agree.
Who are these people?
Yes, and I'll get into it.
Do they treat patients? Do they know what research is?
Exactly. I agree with you. Yes,
they could be anybody.
Exactly. I love it.
You cited your source, so the likelihood is it's probably fine. But
yeah, and I'm about to go into 7 pages of outline of me digging my little squirrel claws through what was available, that at least sifting through myself and being someone who appraises research from time to time, and like distilling it so that our listeners can hopefully understand it. And then also, we show our receipts and our show notes all the time, and you can read them yourselves. Yeah. You can
and our sweaty
too.
Pits when we're done.
Exactly. Can I tell you my chapters now?
I'm ready for your chapters.
Okay, chapter 1, why people be sweaty. Chapter 2,
okay,
can antiperspirants hurt you? Chapter 3, what are our sweat-less, stink-less options? Got it? Perfect.
Ready.
Chapter 1 is the longest, and then they get real. It's kind of like when you go to a play, and the first half is way longer than the second half, so bear with
me.
We're going to need a lot of
We need context, right?
Exactly.
Why, when I'm playing basketball, is there one person I don't want to guard because they're covered in sweat versus the other person who's not? That's what you're
We don't play basketball together. You're not even referring to me.
I'm not.
No. Okay, Chapter 1 is all about the anatomy and pathophysiology of sweat. So, full stop, sweating is normal. Okay, sweating and the evaporation of sweat from our skin is a major component of our body's thermoregulation, which is what, Jeremy?
Our ability to adapt to heat.
Yeah, exactly right. And if you want to learn more about that, see episode 60, How Do I Stay Safe in the Heat, with Zaddy Dr. Josh Blomgren. If you can't or didn't sweat to release heat, your brain would melt, you would have heart arrhythmias, and your kidneys would fail and you would die. Right. So we release a fair amount of salt or sodium when we sweat, which is why some folks who are like salty sweaters might be at higher risk for like heat and sweating related electrolyte issues. That being said, there's not a lot of evidence that sweating does much to like detox you, okay? I'm going to go into this quite a bit. That's why chapter 1 is long, and then because it really explains chapter 2 and chapter 3 pretty quickly.
So chapter 1's really about saunas.
It's about saunas, yes. There's a lot of sauna talk here. I got this great info about sweating written by Lindsay Baker, who's a PhD and the director of the Gatorade Sports Science Institute, which is actually a super reputable organization about sweat and electrolytes. And this was in the form of a really well-written review article that was published in the journal called Temperature, which makes me think of the Sean Paul song.
I was about to say, I was waiting for the next sentence of that or the next word of that. It's just called Temperature.
It's just called Temperature, yeah.
The Temperature
Journal.
This
is in 2019, so this is pretty recent. For instance, sweat glands are perceived to play an important excretory function, meaning, you know, taking things out of your body, similar to that of the renal system, which is responsible for clearing excess micronutrients, metabolic waste, and toxicants from your body. So people think of sweating like they think of your kidneys sometimes, right? Mm-hmm. And this belief can lead to people engaging in practices like prolonged sauna exposure or exercising in uncompensable conditions, like folks that are trying to cut weight by wearing garbage bags or rubber suits, that are designed to induce heavy sweat losses for their perceived health benefits. Okay? We've heard of this. Have you ever done this yourself? Have you ever had to, like,
cut weight?
I was about
to say, you just described Bikram yoga.
That's true, absolutely. However, the effectiveness of sweat glands as an excretory organ for homeostatic purposes, so, like, bringing you into your window of tolerance for all of your humors in your body, is very unclear. There are not comprehensive review articles or data on this topic. So, like, we'll delve into, like, one, there's no data to prove that it does that. Two, there's a fair amount of data that I'm going to go into that proves that it really doesn't. And I would love to go into that. But I would love to start before that with a quick anatomy lesson. But go ahead first.
I feel like the thought process here is, you know, when somebody goes and drinks a ton and they're hungover in the morning and they go and they sweat it out and their sweat does smell like alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, oh, I'm really sweating
we'll
out my
that.
Alcohol, which I think you're going to tell me they don't. But I think that that's the misconception, is kind of like, maybe I'm wrong. But I think the misconception is again, like, I'm detoxing because it's coming out my skin.
Correct. That I'm getting enough out to make a difference for my health. Understood?
But in reality, you're probably just dehydrating yourself further because you, exactly. you were drunk. Okay.
Can I go to the anatomy lesson? Because then I'm going to give you a little bit of a quiz to start off. I want to talk about the types of sweat glands. Jeremy,
apocrine.
how many types of sweat glands are there on our bodies?
Three. Two.
Yeah.
Two to three.
No, you were right with the first one. I thought there were two. There's three. Can you name them? You named one already. What are the other ones?
Apocrine, and then I don't remember the other ones. I was going to say sebaceous. That's a gland.
Ooh,
but it's not.
This is exciting. Okay, I'm going to help you with this. This is fun.
What about the one that's
on
the hair
follicle? It was a trick question. There was a secret fourth one. But okay, here we go. So the first one that I wanted to focus on is eccrine, E-C-C-R-I-N-E. This is the most abundant. There's 2 to 4 million eccrine glands on your body. They're everywhere. They're both on glabrous, which are smooth, non-hairy skin like your palms and your feet, versus non-glabrous or like hairy skin, which is a lot of the rest of you, even like very fine little hairs. And they're responsible, eccrine glands are responsible for thermoregulation. They put out mainly water and salt and some bicarb, and we'll talk about what's in sweat, okay? So that's the most abundant one. It's all over your body. Then you have apocrine. These are folds and face. So axilla, meaning armpit, perineum, meaning you know what the perineum is, your genital regions, groin, taint, whatever you want to call it, under your breasts. Your face and your scalp. So folds and face, right? I made that up. I was really proud of that. The apocrine glands secrete like thick, lipid-rich sweat that's filled with like proteins and sugars and ammonia and pheromones. So we think these are like your stinky glands, right? Great.
Yeah, well, the areas you described are the stinky
the
places.
The stinky areas,
so yes.
Because they have the stinky glands, right? Okay. And then you have apoecrine, or eccrine. So like smush the two together. These are both Z's. Where they're doing both, but they're only found on your armpit. They secrete both water and salt and stinky stuff. So, but what's funny is that they don't really do much for thermoregulation because there's not a lot of easy evaporation in your pitters, right? Like you don't get, unless you're walking around with your arms over your head all the time, you're not going to get a lot of like cooling from evaporation of water out of your armpits.
Sure. That makes sense. So, yes.
Those are the stinkos. And then honorable mention, I'm really proud of you, sebaceous glands, which really aren't a sweat gland. They're their own thing. But they're associated with hair follicles, so they're not on your palms or your soles. And they secrete sebum, so think like pimples. And that's different than apocrine glands. This is like a waxy, cholesterol-rich secretions. They're gross. It's like, where you would get pimples, you know? These are hormonally mediated. And otherwise, we don't know what their importance is. There might be some type of like antibacterial, antifungal properties, but generally they're just there to like maybe cause
torture teenagers.
Right, exactly.
Show us who's going through puberty and,
how their life is so much harder right now.
Keep dermatologists and skin care companies in business.
In business, absolutely. So what is in sweat? Let's talk specifically about eccrine sweat. So there's micronutrients. So this is, again, mainly water, sodium, and chloride. and then smaller amounts of potassium, even smaller amounts of calcium, magnesium, iron, zinc, copper, and other vitamins. So these are like actual nutritive substances. Bicarb is in there too. Then there's non-micronutrients. So these are things like lactate, which are like breakdown of different biochemical processes, urea, so like what's in urine, ammonia, ethanol, like you said, although not in significant enough amounts to like detox like your liver does, but definitely when people sweat, they will sweat out some alcohol. Bicarbonate, oh sorry, I guess it's in the non-micronutrients, sorry about that. Glucose, heavy metals, antibodies, proteins, cytokines, enzymes, and other like toxicants, okay?
It's a party in there.
It's a party in the, so this is all in your sweat, but the most of like the vast majority of what's in your Ekron sweat is water and sodium chloride, okay? There's other toxicants that they're referring to, include things like your favorite things, BPA, and your favorite word that you think you can't say, but you're pretty good at it.
Phthalates.
Yeah. And then PBDEs, which I forgot what the long thing means, but similar stuff. The data shows that the presence in the sweat secretions is likely super overestimated and doesn't really correlate to blood levels of these substances. So you can have them like undetectable or very, very low in your blood, and then they're really hyper-concentrated in your skin when you sweat. And there's some reasons behind this, and I'll get to that. So we'll get there. Okay. There's not enough evidence that I saw in a lot of different studies that sweating these out serves as true or significant detoxification in any way. The liver is the winner when it comes to the metabolism of toxicants. And then the liver then excretes those metabolites through, usually for the vast, vast, vast majority goes through your kidneys and your GI tract. So poo, poo, pee, pee out. Right? Jeremy, who do you think would win in like a detox fight? Your sweat glands or your kidneys? When we're talking like salt, water, and like these toxicants.
Meaning which one would put out the most?
Yeah, who's the winner?
I would think the kidneys.
Yes. Kidneys win by KO in the first round. There is no David and Goliath parallels here. Goliath be winning, okay? So kidneys and sweat glands, they do have some similarities. And that's why people think of them similarly. You know, they are responsible for sodium chloride and bicarbonate homeostasis, fluid regulation via, you know, the same like hormonal things that help our kidneys to like pee things out more or hold on to water more. Things like aldosterone, AVP, these other hormones that we won't go into. Sweat glands can also reabsorb. I didn't really know this. This is probably me being embarrassing as a physician. But sweat glands also reabsorb sodium and chloride and bicarb, just like the kidneys, to mm-hmm. aid in electrolyte balance in a much lower way than your kidneys do. However, they can't really reabsorb water like the kidneys do. So they don't really help to like conserve fluid losses. So like if you were dehydrated because of a lot of reasons, you're sweating out your bender the night before and you went and you sweated out in a sauna, you're going to lose a bunch of fluid. You're already dehydrated. And if that fluid just sat on your skin can't absorb that water back in. But it can absorb some degree of the sodium and the chloride and the bicarb to like help your electrolytes a little bit. Not as well as the kidneys can, though. Okay? That's where they're similar and that's it. Now the dissimilarities. Stop me whenever you want, or I'm just going to keep going because I'm excited about this. So the dissimilarities are the removal of toxicants thing like we talked about. In general, sweating, even though it's interesting to talk about culturally to like sweat it out or like sweat out your toxins and all that, our sweat glands suck at this. They're not good at it. And there's confusing and conflicting data that is probably why people, there's a misconception as to why they might be good at it. Yes, we find toxicants in sweat, like BPA and heavy metals and phthalates. But they're sometimes at higher concentrations than in blood or urine, so you're like, why? Why is there more on sweating out in your skin than there was in your pee or in your blood? Part of the reason is that sweat collections methods in data collection in these studies are sus, meaning the studies don't count for the evaporation of water, so you're getting like hyper concentrates of these things on your skin. The skin surface contamination, a lot of the studies asked participants to like unsupervised scrape the sweat off their skin using a metal mm-hmm. spatula. So it contained a bunch of sebum and crud and like stuff. It was contaminants. So a counter to this, when they look at kidney studies about toxicants, specifically we'll talk about BPA, okay? Renal studies, kidney studies show that blood BPA is eliminated within 5 to 7 hours. 84% to 97% of it is gone, peed out. They can see it. And then after 24 hours, 100% of it is peed out. So you have it in your blood, they watch it. After 24 hours, 100% of it, if they're accounting for every BPA molecule that you ingested, it's gone, okay? Fecal studies, so poo-poo studies, show that heavy metal excretion, so now we're talking about the other types of toxicants, you know, or some other types, is mainly via the GI tract. So there's a ton of data that shows already like how our filtration systems deal with a lot of this stuff. And so even though we're finding it in our sweat, it's sort of like there's no mechanism that is known in the 100 plus years of understanding our sweat and our sweat glands that accounts for this. Does that make sense?
Yes.
There's not like, it's not a thing you can read in a book of like, and here's the mechanism of how your sweat glands purge out this BPA. But we know that about our kidneys, and we know the other ways that our liver and our GI tract does it. Okay.
Well, and you referenced this already, but I was thinking back to the episode where we've talked about some of this stuff, and it's in the air, and so it's going to be sitting on our skin. Our skin is external; it's our biggest barrier to everything on the outside. So, if you asked me to collect sweat and it was unsupervised, I probably have BPA already sitting on my skin right now.
Exactly.
Also, statistically speaking, that metal spatula may have some BPA sitting on it.
Totally.
So, again, I think it depends on how controlled they were. But the kidney's inside me. It's sterile to a certain extent, right?
Exactly.
And so it's just going to be better sampling.
Yeah, and you can control for some confounding variables, especially if you're giving people a very specific amount of BPA and then you're watching it go through their system. Go ahead.
I also have this weird metaphor that I keep thinking in my head or analogy as you're going through. I'm thinking of, like, the kidney as, like, you know, when you flush your toilet and all the shit goes down and goes out, it goes through these big pipes and everybody's is going through these big pipes and it goes and it's just high flow goes through and then the water's cleaned and such. And it's the equivalent of taking all that stuff and just like putting it on soil is your skin and being like, will it eventually go away? And the answer is yes.
Sure.
Will it do it as well as the other thing?
No.
No.
Because the ground outside is not toilet.
So that I just think of the toilet pipes being like the kidneys and the ground outside is like my skin.
Perfect.
They both can do the job, just not the same.
The last thing that is the sort of confounding variables of these studies, the ones looking at like what's in sweat and seeing toxicants and stuff in people's sweat. A lot of these are like sauna studies, where participants were exposed to like 2 to 5 hours a day of excessive sweating. So it comes back to like when we've talked about other exposure to toxins before, of like giving a rat an unbelievable amount of the substance and then being like, look, it made their brain explode. And it's like, well, we only get like 1/1 trillionth of that substance. So like, what are you talking about? So these were sauna studies where people were sweating excessively for 2 to 5 hours a day. And then they were also, oftentimes the studies were confounded by asking the participants to like change their diet or their exercise patterns or sleep in like different major ways. So there's a lot of concerns that these sparse findings are not applicable to like everyday sweat life. Like, are you sweating excessively 2 to 5 hours a day? I hope not.
Well, I mean, if climate change is real, we all will be in the future, but exactly. Currently, correct, no.
Okay. All right. So that's our chapter one of, like, why we be sweaty. And the answer is because if we didn't, we wouldn't be able to release heat and we would melt our brains. Cool?
Yeah, I think you've laid a nice groundwork for we all need to sweat. And then I think maybe more importantly, the thing that you've established is, like, why do we stink in some areas and why we don't stink in other areas.
In others, certainly.
And we're going to talk about some of those areas.
Sure. Well, now we're going to talk about, can antiperspirants hurt you? Okay? This is chapter two. All right, so who do you think is the big bad wolf in the antiperspirants will make you sick fairy tale? Who's the big bad wolf, do you think, when we're talking about
big tech?
No, like what part of antiperspirants are the bad guy?
Oh, I thought you were talking about who was behind all the badness.
No. Like what's the actual substance that we're supposed to be afraid of?
Aluminum.
Yeah, there you go. Good job. Good job, Boo.
But not like the stuff in my can here.
Well, yes. So aluminum is ubiquitous. It is the third most common element in Earth's crust. So avoiding aluminum is impossible. Even if you boycotted aluminum pots and pans and cans and antiperspirants, it's still in the food you eat and the water you drink and in the air you breathe, okay? On average, most people take in about 30 to 50 milligrams per day of aluminum just from eating food, like regular food.
Horseshit.
No. More aluminum. Less? I don't know. So then there's also over-the-counter medications like antacids that are just a bunch of aluminum. And then there's also like buffered aspirins that you could, it's up to like 5 grams a day if you're like taking some Tums or something or Mylanta, okay? At that level, there's very little evidence of harm. And this is like consensus studies over and over again, okay?
I know, but I just felt like you were leading me down this path. I feel like you're just leading me down the pathway of like, and they've said it's increasing the risk of autism because there's more aluminum in the crust is putting out more aluminum.
No.
That's where I thought we were headed.
Well, let's talk about the data on aluminum toxicity then, okay?
Okay.
This is an article in, I'm going to try to say it right. I actually had Google try to tell me, Deutsche Ärzteblatt, which just means German Physicians Medical Journal from 2017. It's called The Health Effects of Aluminum Exposure. And this is like a big study that a lot of people are quoting, and I like it. And I think it's valid. The reference values, so I'm going to do a lot of technical speak, but I'm going to try to make it not boring. So the reference values for just regular day-to-day people, that their normal internal aluminum load, like if you were going to take a blood test and it was like, you know, like you look at the reference levels and like whether or not you're in the green or the, you know, the red, normal is less than 15 micrograms per liter in urine and less than 5 micrograms per liter in serum. Who cares? You don't have to remember that, but that's the numbers. This study showed that these values are very likely to be exceeded in people with occupational exposure, like welders and workers in the aluminum industry. And the biological tolerance value, so for people that work there that we think is like kind of their normal-ish or like, you know, on a bell curve, what most people are at, is around 50 micrograms in the urine. So like for you, it'd be less than 15. For welder person, 50, okay?
3 times as much.
Sure. When they looked at aluminum welders and workers in the aluminum industry, when they saw people that were having declining performance in neuropsychological tests, so like attention, learning, memory, it was only found with aluminum concentration exceeding 100 in the urine, all right? And they also never, when they looked at this big population of people, and I have to look back at like what all the numbers were, and my understanding of this was actually kind of like a group of studies. There was no correlation with encephalopathy, so people that had like major brain disorders or dementia. They didn't see that in people. Because I want to get into later, I'm foreshadowing the big two scares about aluminum and antiperspirants, okay? So yes, there was some correlation with higher levels of aluminum causing changes in people's ability to think at their regular level, sort of, attention, learning, and memory.
So like cognitive tests?
Correct.
Like cognitive tests.
Neuropsych testing, exactly.
But it sounds like you're not describing pathology. It's like
I'm not I'm describing potentially pathology, but I'm not prescribing or not I'm not describing dementia. Like progressive worsening cognitive decline, the end. Okay? So now let's go on to, okay, well, that's one study. Now here's a study that says, well, there's elevated aluminum content that's been found in the brains of people with Alzheimer's disease. And we'll get into that a little bit later, not very long from now. So they've seen it. They've seen it in the brains of people with Alzheimer's disease, and I'll kind of explain why that's there. But it's really very unclear whether it's a cause or an effect of the disease or if it just happens to be there for no good reason. There's very also conflicting evidence on, and I'll get into that too, carcinogenicity or like whether or not it causes or is associated with cancer. So basically the contention with at least this big German study or collection of studies was that the use of aluminum-containing antiperspirants and the exposure that you would get as a normal human being who's putting it on your armpits, that the possibility that would promote breast cancer is not supported by consistent scientific data. And again, I'm going to break this down into the two major problems, which I'll just go into now unless you would like to say something.
No, I'm just confused where breast cancer came at the end there, because I feel like
I'm about to talk about breast cancer.
I know, but the study didn't talk about breast cancer up until that point. I was following you up until it started, like, they were talking about cognitive tests throughout the, and like,
yes. And I think that it's because this was like a kind of a, it was a meta-analysis, and, it, and I was sort of breaking down the conclusions at the end of it. So now I'd like to get into more.
It also looked at cancer, is what
you're
saying.
Yes, and I'm right, and I'm going to go into the whole breast cancer thing. So first, I want to give some background as to like why this folklore began, between the connection of aluminum and antiperspirants and breast cancer. There's a few hypotheses. One was that instructions that women avoid antiperspirants, deodorants, and powders and lotions before they get a mammogram, to avoid like confusing shadows on the X-ray. So I don't know if you, like. I feel like I, well, we'll get into this because I'm getting my first mammogram this year, and we're going to have a great breast cancer expert coming up pretty soon. But yeah, like they tell you, like, don't put on any lotions or anything on your skin before you get your mammogram. Okay. And then the second thing that probably drummed up the connection here was that anonymous chain email letter. The letter claimed that inhibiting perspiration causes harmful substances to be trapped in the body where they can form cancer. So here's another great quote. I'm not going to make you do it. I'll do it myself. This is from Dr. William Tice. He's a PhD. Well, he was a PhD epidemiologist, cancer researcher, and was the editor of the American Cancer Society Journal. And he said, it would be nice if as many people as those who forwarded the email about antiperspirants urged their friends and relative to get a mammogram every year starting at age 40. We would have saved a lot more lives.
I mean, it's just like, I mean, you could take so many, that quote sums up so many things in medicine.
Yeah, it's baller. I loved it. So here's the skinny from the NIH's National Cancer Institute website about this. And there's a bunch of information here, and it's great. Okay, so only a few studies have investigated a possible relationship between breast cancer and underarm antiperspirants. One study was in 2002. It did not show any increase in risk for breast cancer among women who reported using an underarm antiperspirant or deodorant. The results also showed no increase in breast cancer risk among women who used a razor and antiperspirant or deodorant within an hour of, like, shaving. These conclusions were based on interviews with 813 women with breast cancer and 793 women with no history of breast cancer. So pretty good quality study. There was another study in 06, no association between antiperspirant use and breast cancer risk, although it was only like 54 and 50 women, like in the treatment and control. Mm-hmm. There was a 2003 retrospective cohort study, which should raise a little bit of a red flag, but that's okay. Still a study, but we'll talk about levels of evidence, examining the frequency of armpit shaving and using antiperspirants among 437 breast cancer survivors. And that study reported there was a younger age at breast cancer diagnosis for women that used antiperspirants frequently or started using them together with shaving at an earlier age. But because this is a retrospective nature of the study, these results, I would say, and the
so
authors of that,
holes.
So we're not conclusive.
So many holes in that.
I don't like it. I was almost not going to mention it, but it's also like, it's nice to mention studies that are
You have to mention great. You have to mention it because it's, it gives us an opportunity to say, like, the reason why that data sucks is you're taking after the fact situation. Yes. So all these people had breast cancer, and then you're saying, okay, well, how much of you did this aluminum stuff and shaved at the same time or whatever? And you're like, oh, look, there were more, but like your cohorts 450s.
It wasn't even that there were more. They all had breast cancer. They just said that there was a correlation that they got their diagnosis at a younger age.
Right.
Which, and again, I think means nothing. Yeah,
it means,
trash.
I mean, there's so many reasons for that. It's garbage.
Agreed. Because these studies of antiperspirants and deodorants and breast cancer have provided very conflicting results, I would say they're not conflicting. They're saying there's no evidence of causation here.
One more thing.
Yes.
I should finish the last sentence with being, it should encourage us to look further into it.
Yes, of course.
Right. Like, I want to make sure we're very clear that that's garbage. It is garbage data. But it's not garbage, like, you shouldn't look into it. Because I do think that sometimes the feeling from the general public is that we say it's garbage and that we don't even think it's worth looking into.
No, and that's, like, not the point.
It's two separate thoughts. Like, it just needs better evidence, for sure.
Yeah. Okay. And even the authors of this study, and that's the point of journal club, which is kind of what we're doing with everybody here, right? Is to talk about a study and to talk about what was good about it, what was bad about it, what could be better about it. And part of doing a research study and presenting that data is to have that internal analysis and show it to everybody. And if you're not doing that, then you have not only bad data, but you're not insightful or transparent about your bad data. Right?
Totally.
That's what we're talking about here. All right. Can we talk about Alzheimer's disease?
Sure.
So that's the breast cancer data, which is crap in my mind. How did these rumors start about Alzheimer's disease? Well, it's kind of harkening back to what I talked about in the beginning. And a little bit more background. In the 1960s, there were animal studies. There was a rabbit study that showed that there was high levels of aluminum exposure correlated to brain nerve toxicity in rabbits. So again, give rabbits a whole bunch of aluminum and see what happens, and it caused brain toxicity, okay? They also said, studies around the similar time frame, so we're talking many, many decades ago now, that long-term dialysis patients that had high blood aluminum levels also had a higher risk of developing dementia. Again, many confounding factors there. People mm-hmm. that have dialysis, that are on dialysis, don't have functioning, well-functioning kidneys and need a machine to do that for them. So there may be something completely other than the aluminum levels in their blood that may be correlating to their risk of dementia, okay? Now we're going to go back to when I said I was going to come to this now. Aluminum has been found in the neurofibrillary tangles in the brain that characterize Alzheimer's disease. So Alzheimer's disease, you create these weird little proteinaceous plaques. They're called neurofibrillary tangles, and they clog up your brain, and that's what we can see with our eyes when we look at someone's brain who's died of Alzheimer's disease, and we slice it up and look at another microscope, okay? So, back to William Tice. He calls the notion that antiperspirants could cause Alzheimer's disease an old legend. So what he says is, one of the things that happens in Alzheimer's brains is that they shrink. So you have accumulated a certain amount of aluminum in your brain, and as your brain shrinks, the concentration is going to appear high compared to a regular brain. So that's part of it, too, is that it just concentrates kind of the same way we were seeing concentrated toxicants on your skin. So it is kind of a little thing from old Bill. There was a 2021 Canadian study that was commissioned to determine whether or not there was a link between aluminum and drinking water and Alzheimer's disease. And through a long distillation, I will just tell you, the study found that there was absolutely no clear the study showed that there was no clear correlation at all between the amount of aluminum in the Canadian drinking water and risk of Alzheimer's disease. Okay? There was also a 2017 Chinese toxicology clinical review that looked at heavy metal levels in patients with Alzheimer's, and they saw some degree of correlation, but not enough data to imply any type of causation. So they're basically saying, like, compared to controls, the levels in the blood of aluminum and then other things like mercury, cadmium, were significantly higher, but then also the levels of lead were reduced in Alzheimer's disease patients. So they were saying these findings suggest that elevated aluminum, mercury, and cadmium in the circulation, especially in like flowing around in your serum and your blood, may play a role in the progression of Alzheimer's disease, not necessarily whether or not you were going to get it. So it's kind of a sticky study of like, hey, these people that had worse Alzheimer's disease that they already had it and it was progressing, they had higher levels of these things. So it kind of reminds me a little bit of the dialysis information. Here's my take on all of it. The general consensus of experts, including statements released by the Alzheimer's Association, the World Health Association, the NIH, and the EPA, are all saying that aluminum exposure is not a key risk factor in developing Alzheimer's disease. So you talked about, in that first quote, like the seven people in your car, this is a consensus among the kind of world-leading organizations whose job it is to inform us about health risks.
Yeah, I mean, if you told me my epidemiologist was the society that represents all epidemiologists, my thought process has changed.
Exactly.
You've changed the people in the car with me.
It's a much bigger car.
So the summary of this so far is that for breast cancer and for Alzheimer's, there doesn't seem to be a big link between aluminum and developing those, at least in terms of like substantial data.
Correct.
So even if you had high aluminum in your body, the likelihood of getting those things, at least at this point from data, is that it's low.
Correct. Or that it's no different than...
Or non-existent.
Exactly. There's not a statistical significance. That's my phthalates, is saying statistical significance.
That's true. You've said that before.
It's very hard.
I have a question. So,
yes.
Has anybody done the study of seeing whether we use antiperspirants with aluminum, whether we actually do get increased aluminum in our body compared to not doing that?
That's a good question. 'Cause the answer is, I'm sure it exists, but...
I'm not sure it exists. I mean, you just did
a ton
of research.
I did. I did not come across that in many...
It just seems like you did a lot of mm-hmm. great work to look through all this information to basically say, like, will aluminum cause harm to us? And what has not been established is, who cares if we're not even getting aluminum right. in our bodies from the antiperspirant? Like, if it doesn't even raise my levels, it doesn't matter.
Yeah. I didn't look specifically for... Is there a study that looks at that specifically? What I'm basing this on is I looked at so many studies that were talking about this, of like risk of like even like the aluminum toxicity study, and just like what's in our sweat and all that, and like the physiology of how our sweat glands work. And the concept is that we absorb things through our skin not well in general. And our sweat glands in particular, like the point of aluminum is that it clogs up your sweat glands. So something else in your skin needs to be absorbing it. Like clearly we absorb some stuff in our skin. Like there's medications that, you know, like you put steroids on your skin, you're going to get some systemic absorption of that. You know, Voltaren gel goes on your skin and it's supposed to help locally your anti-inflammatory, whatever. So I'm kind of like riffing here a little bit, but, I would say our skin in general does a poor job of absorbing anything back in except for sodium, chloride, and bicarbonate. We can't even absorb water back in.
Right. So, because I think that those are two very different views of
yes.
could antiperspirants cause problems for me? Because the data that you have given me to date is saying, is aluminum causing me the problem if I'm exposed to it? And it seems like the other school of thought here is that all it's doing is clogging the stuff, mm-hmm. and therefore things can't get out.
Correct.
And if things can't get out, those are the things that can cause me harm. Not the aluminum, but the fact that those things can't get out.
And I think that the data is showing us that both things don't cause what we think it's causing. Meaning, like, the fact that you can't sweat out of your armpits because you put an aluminum-containing substance on your skin that blocks your sweat glands from being able to output your what's mainly water... sodium, chloride, and bicarb, and to very, very, very small amounts, other stuff, does not correlate to disease, period, that we're aware of because of just how we understand the physiology of how sweating works. But also that even if you were to absorb a lot of aluminum through your armpits, which you don't, you would need higher levels than someone that welds all day long to even have any type of known problems. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay.
From Penn Medicine, there's recent research published by National Center for Biotechnology Information suggests that frequent use of antiperspirants can cause aluminum to accumulate in breast tissue, but that doesn't prove that aluminum salts can cause breast cancer.
Right.
So I guess in theory it can get into the tissue, so you can absorb it, but there's nothing with blood levels. This just seems like such an easy study. You just, you take 500 people and say you use antiperspirants that have aluminum in them. You take the other 500 people and you say use deodorants that don't have aluminum in them. We're going to take your blood a few times and yeah. we're going to figure out if there's more aluminum in it. And it's
in
just
it.
That
in
seems
or,
like such
or,
an
or or your point is that fine, what if we're but what you just told me, that Penn thing, is not even saying we care about what your level is in your blood. They're saying your level in your breast
in
is
the
what
breast
matters
tissue.
So like,
well,
maybe it,
they were saying that's what they were referencing
is, it, yes.
I was just trying to get to the bottom of, like, does it actually
I know.
Get in there? But again, I think to this point, what I've heard, and you can edit me as after I say it, is aluminum, the data on aluminum in my body is I'd have to get to extremely high levels that, like, rats get, mm-hmm. or rabbits.
Rabbits.
And dose and exposure matters, as we've always said, and it doesn't mm-hmm. seem like, certainly through my antiperspirants, I'm getting anywhere close to having issues, and it's all associative data, and the associative data is actually pretty crappy to start with. So I shouldn't be worried about that being the problem, and then storing up the other stuff, meaning blocking my armpits from getting stuff out, seems, again, weak at best, but maybe hasn't been studied as directly in terms of, like, what actually stuff is being built up and therefore, I guess, in theory, needs more research, but still seems, at this point,
low yield.
Not a reason to stop my subscribe and save.
Right. So, yeah, here now I'm in chapter 3. Okay, fine, I just listened to you and I don't want to believe science. I want to know if natural deodorant is better. So give me that science. So
I mean, that's marketing. Yes, well done. Use the word natural.
Perfect. So this chapter is short, and I'm going to snap back to that New York Times article that we first started with about natural deodorants that I started this whole mess with. So let's give some claims that people that might be advertising their natural deodorant. So it's better for your microbiome, okay? This is probably neutral. I don't know. I don't think we understand enough about the microbiome. I think we have to ask Alessio Fasano to come back on and talk about armpit microbiome. But, you know, this is mainly just marketing claims of being microbiome friendly. It's something you'll see on packaging and that by the natural brands that don't have any data to back that up. So that's one. How about the ingredients are cleaner? That's better. No. The term natural, like you said, has no regulatory definition. It's meaningless. It doesn't mean anything. What's natural, you know?
There's nothing more natural than the atomic number 13 on your chart, aluminum, which is, as you mentioned, the third most prevalent
thing in our crust. Do you think people are mad at it because it's number 13 and so
element,
they're like being like
element?
Okay. Do you think they're mad at it because it's number 13 and so they're real spooky about it?
I guess, but like that's the thing is like you can't get more natural than
aluminum,
like one
it's
of our
crust.
core element. Yeah. So like,
well, okay. So what are these clean ingredients? So mainly it's baking soda, essential oils, and fragrances. And dermatologists, of which there was many, you know, experts talking about it there was a couple in the New York Times article, are saying that all of these things can cause skin irritation and contact dermatitis, basically rashes. So our armpits are more susceptible than, say, like our back skin because of all the juicy folds, right? The hair that's there. And it's just like thinner skin. So we're more apt to have like allergic response or an immune response or like an irritant response to even just things that are natural. And dermatologists see it all the time. All right. Well, does it make you less stinky? Maybe. It depends. It depends on the natural deodorant. So the stink that you get when you sweat comes from the skin bacteria. So Staph hominis is like the major player here. And the bacteria breaks down your sweat into thioalkohols. Thio is one of the root words for sulfur. So that's why they stinks, you know, smelly egg sulfur smell. So some natural deodorants, like the brand Lumi and some of the other newer ones, use something called mandelic acid, which comes from bitter almonds and other like these carboxylic acids to acidify the skin. And they're trying to disallow the bacteria to propagate. So their whole thing is like, put this on you, it'll acidify your skin, it'll stop the bacteria from propagating, and it basically stops them from eating the sweat and farting out the thioalkohols and making you smell bad. And there is some data and science behind that. However, counterpoint, blocking the eccrine or the apoeccrine glands from releasing the sweat in the first place, which is what antiperspirants do, controls the food source. So there's a fair amount of like data and consensus that antiperspirants might be more effective in destinkifying because you don't give them the bacteria, the food to begin with, to make you smell bad, to fart it out. So, you know, there's information there. The New York Times article interviewed an NYU dermatologist named Dr. Ariel Nagler, who said, who was talking about the effectiveness of a natural deodorant product will also depend on how it interacts with your own biology. So this is kind of going back to the microbiome situation. And Dr. Nagler said, everyone smells a little bit different, which depends on how much you sweat and what kinds of bacteria are on your body. So it, you know, it's not a one-size-fits-all, just like how Dr. Fasano in the past had talked about, like, microbiome medicine needs to be very individualized. So that's the destinkifying thing. I had one little last bonus piece of information, and then I'm pretty much done. But I'd like to stop and let you reflect if you'd like.
Yeah, I'm just reflecting on how aluminum has become the demonized word in the natural
battle. Because we just found something, and we wanted to blame
it. But, like, mandelic acid, right? Which, yeah. I don't know how it got its name. If they called it what it really is, which is an aromatic alpha hydroxy acid,
right.
And showed you AHA, the yeah. molecular formula, which is mm-hmm. C6H5CHOHCO2H, in its white crystalline solid, you know, like, I just...
Why is that? Like, okay, yeah.
I feel like that's less natural than
But it comes
aluminum.
From almonds, Jeremy. Almonds are cool. We like those. They've got great SEO.
I mean, aluminum chlorohydrate... which is AlCl3
sounds H2O. Scarier.
I guess.
Yeah, I know. I know. It's
but,
all...
But
chemicals
I'm a
are
victim
normal.
Of
we are chemicals. We're a big bag of chemicals. That's what our friends on Unbiased Science
I'm a victim
say
of this.
Right?
I'm a victim
I know,
of
me
it too,
we all
though.
Are. Yeah.
I look at my deodorant and or my antiperspirant, and I'm like, ooh. It says aluminum tetrachloride. Like, I probably shouldn't be using it. And the Tom's one has a beautiful... rose garden on the front and says it's all natural, and you're like, that's probably
yeah but sometimes
for me,
like essential oils and the fragrances they put in there hurt your armpit skin. I mean, it's going to give your armpit skin cancer? No, I mean, not any more than rubbing flour on it, but
I agree with you completely. I think that yeah. My thought process is
I know
bunk.
Why we hate on aluminum, right? Yeah, well, here's do you want to hear my bonus? Because this was where I was the most frustrated in writing this outline. I can't tell you how many things I put into the Google search bar to try to get any type of scholarly article about this. And this is the thing that I think everybody wants to know the answer to this question. So I had a very hard time pouring through the evidence to get a straight answer to what specific chemical compounds react to make yellow pit stains. It was very hard to find.
Right, because the antiperspirant is what causes the yellow pit stains, but deodorants do not,
you know,
right?
You know where I saw that? It was referenced a million times in natural deodorant ads, and I had a banger of a time trying to find any type of actual study about it. It was all referencing a reference of a reference. I was like, did somebody just make this up? Is that real? And maybe I'm just bad at this. But anyway, and in the end, the best answer that I could find is that it's a mixture of the urea and the ammonia, sebum, so like the oily stuff on your skin, reacting with the bacteria on your skin in conjunction with aluminum, zirconium, tetrachlorohydrex gly that make the stubborn yellow stains. You know where I got this from? The actual, like, scientific data that showed me this? It was from a study at the World Textile Conference about novel washing algorithms to remove stains.
Shit.
It was the most, because really, the answer is who cares? I care.
It's probably true, but it also seems like another easy study. It's like, all right, we're gonna get 300 people together. 150 of you are gonna use regular deodorant that doesn't have aluminum in it. The other,
I didn't believe them that they were like, oh, it's only because it just seemed like all these natural deodorant brands were like, it's your deodorant, it's your antiperspirant that's making your pits yellow, and it's like, really. Really, I have so many pitted out white shirts, and
right, we're gonna
for, like,
how many days do you need? Like, we probably do like what, 10 to 15 days is probably enough data, right?
So, like, experiment in school in middle
school. You send everybody like 15 white Hanes T-shirts that they mm-hmm. have to wear all day, mm-hmm. And you send them their deodorant or their antiperspirant, and you just mm-hmm. say, once you wear it for the whole day, you take it off. It doesn't get washed. You put it in this bag, and you're yeah. gonna send them all back to us, and we're gonna just examine all 15 yeah. of your shirts and compare it. And I
you
feel like
we
find
first,
out the answer.
You would get blue ribbon first prize in the 7th grade science fair project.
In the Who Cares journal.
I know, but I care because I want to know. Because it happens to me and it sucks. And I'm glad that this like washing stuff journal is like, hey, they were literally replicating putting the chemicals on fabric to see if they could replicate what the chemical reaction was so that they could also break it down so that they can rid you of the stain.
Yeah, in fairness, I have shirts that I've had that same yellow thing show up in necks, though.
Yes.
And I don't put any antiperspirant
up
there. Agreed! So, like, mm-hmm. is it just my sebum? Is it, am I just, do I just have yellow sebum?
Stop talking about your sebum.
It's a perfect way to end.
This is all I have.
What would you like our yellow pitted stained frustrated listener to do?
This deep dive into stinky armpits was kind of exhausting, and I gotta admit, it gave me a little bit of flop sweat myself. So it's up to you, dear listener, if you want to be a stinky little baby or you want to lather yourself with aluminum, you're going to be fine.
We will take a 5-star review, though. Thanks, if you don't mind. It would be really helpful for the podcast.
Or I'll sweat more, so help me. Listen to your doctor friend.
The amazing music is credited to SkillCell with Pixabay licensure. The podcast is meant for educational and entertainment purposes only. The contents of this podcast should not be taken as medical advice to treat any medical condition in either yourself or others. Please consult a medical professional for any medical issues that you may be having. The contents of this podcast are the opinions of the hosts only and do not reflect the opinions of their employers or affiliations. This entire disclaimer also applies to any guests or contributors to the podcast. Under no circumstances shall Dr. Julie Bruni or Dr. Jeremy Allen or any guest to the podcast be responsible for damages arising from use of the podcast.